Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the Command Show.
Science 5, Engine 101.
With Anthony Castros and Ed Hadfield. Let's start the show.
Welcome to the Command Show with Anthony Castros and Ed Hadfield. Thank you all for everyone who's already actually gotten in the chat room and all you firefighters out there listening in. We are coming to you live tonight from Monterey, California, the site of our latest training. We're doing Mastering the Fire Service Assessment Center here in Monterey, California. And the workshop name is a bit deceiving. The actual workshop is really about not only getting ready for promotion and the promotional process, but more importantly about the job. And so tonight's show is going to be enhanced by the presence of our class. We're going to be having about 25 students here in the class with us coming over from the room adjacent. They're finishing up their first day of the workshop today. They're going to come over and have some questions for us tonight regarding command, leadership, and other hot topics in the fire service. So I want to welcome them in a little bit here. And my partner, Ed, will be joining us. He's actually teaching a class out in Lincoln, Nebraska tonight, this week, and he'll be joining us in about 15 minutes or so. So we're going to have a pretty powered-up night with a lot of folks calling in from throughout the country, a lot of folks here from throughout the country in our workshop this week, and also all of you hopefully chatting in and so forth. I want to do a shout-out to some of the folks who were already coming in, Dean Edwards, Ethan Bancic, and, of course, Jim Wolkowski, the chief up there at Riverside Fire Rescue up in Washington. So the workshop that we're doing this week covers the gamut of knowledge, skills, and abilities to be an excellent officer, and we break them down into three dimensions. The first one is leadership, of course, most important, and the biggest problem we're seeing in the fire service right now is a lack of leadership, and that sounds cliche. The word leadership is certainly overused in the fire service, and that's probably the part of the problem. We pay it a lot of lip service. Unfortunately, leadership is defined by action, and that's the thing that we're not seeing enough of in the American Fire Service, is action. So that's one of the issues we're going to be talking about tonight, is just flat-out leadership. What's it look like? What's it look like when it's not happening? And is having a cert on the wall enough anymore? Of course not. You could have a PhD in leadership. Unless that education, unless it manifests itself in tangible, visible action, it really doesn't matter how much training you have. It really doesn't matter how much of a pedigree you have on the wall. We need to see that action. And so we're going to talk about that tonight. We're going to talk about the management dimension. It's not just about people. It's about things. Right now, today's fire officers are dealing with an unprecedented amount of information coming at them at a faster rate than has ever been seen before. We are being scrutinized more. The average American is being videotaped almost 20 times a day without them even knowing it, whether it's security cameras or someone pulling out their iPad or iPhone and videotaping you, or maybe at a bank, maybe at an ATM, or maybe walking through a store. You're being videoed more often than you realize, and that is transitioning over to our world as firefighters. Most of the time, if you were to stop and look up during a fire at the public or look up during a vehicle accident that you're working, you're going to probably see dozens of iPhone cameras, iPad cameras, and the like on you without you even realizing it. So it's even gotten to the point now where firefighters, some of the newer kids coming up, their priority is actually it's a higher priority for them to show up and whip out their iPhone and start videotaping how cool they look on their fire than actually doing their job, which is despicable. That's the kind of stuff we're going to be talking about tonight. The third dimension is what we talk about in this workshop, or I'm sorry, in this radio show on a regular basis, which is command, strategy, tactics, the incident command system, and so forth. So we'll be delving into that too as well. Before we get too much further, I want to go ahead and give an opportunity to share one of our, and actually our first sponsor for the Fire Engineering Blog Talk Radio shows, and we're very honored to have the Granger here, so I'm going to go ahead and run that for you, and take a listen to this, this from
With an industry-leading distribution network, Grainger can save you tons of downtime by offering over 900,000 products, many ready to ship right when you need them. In fact, 99% of items ordered ship same day. So fast, the International Acronym Committee is considering changing ASAP to ASAG, or as soon as Grainger. At least they would be considering it if there were such a committee. To help keep your business running efficiently, call clickgrainger.com or stop by a branch today. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Okay, thanks from Grainger for being our first official sponsor at the Fire Engineering Blog Talk radio shows. I am very honored and thankful to be part of this program, as is Ed Hatfield. And also want to thank Bobby Halton, Diane Rothschild, and the rest of the folks at Fire Engineering Penwell for allowing this show to happen. It's critical. One of the things that we're doing up at my neck of the woods at Metro Fire in Sacramento is conducting a battalion chief academy, which is coming up at the end of this month, which is an in-house academy of training for our new and aspiring battalion chiefs, the folks that have just been promoted, and the folks that are on the promotional list. As all of you, I'm sure, are experiencing, we have an unprecedented amount of upward mobility in our organizations. The vast amount of experienced officers are leaving. They're retiring, and we have just a huge influx of folks coming up, which is a good thing, but it can also be a very challenging and dangerous thing. We've got folks who don't know what they don't know in some cases, albeit very dedicated and intelligent folks. They just don't have the street experience, the fire ground experience, the emergency scene experience that those who are leaving them have or had. Case in point, we had an engineer and a captain retire out of my house on a different shift. Just the two of them alone represented almost 80 years of fire service experience. And just to give a little bit of context to that, our latest recruit class was 26 people. All 26 of them would have to be on the job for over 3 years to backfill that void that we're losing. But as we've heard in a lot of our conferences, workshops, and so forth, it's not all about experience. Just years on the job is not enough. It takes education. It takes practice. It takes reflection. It takes looking in the mirror with a sober attitude to be good at this job, and more importantly, to lead those who are good in this job. So these are important topics that we're facing in this day and age. We're only 2 months away from FDIC. In April of this year, it's going to be a powered-up week, as it always is. We expect some 30,000 firefighters from not only across the United States, but outside, across the international arena, to be coming to FDIC. We're excited to have them coming out. And the schedule for FDIC is already out, and the classes, the workshops, classroom sessions, pre-conference workshops are already there. I'm happy to say I'm going to be able to have the good fortune again to be teaching there this year, and I'm excited about doing that, and also talking at the opening ceremony. I'm going to be giving a little talk about what we're facing. Right now, this is our time, and I think one of the things that we do in the fire service, which is a great thing, is we tend to celebrate all of our heroes, and rightfully so. However, we tend to spend our time looking over our shoulder at who came ahead of us. Sometimes we need to look up in front of us and what's coming, what's in the future. So not only who came before us, but what are we going to do? Who are we as a generation? That's very, very critical that we define that. There's some huge leadership problems in the American Fire Service right now. And it's not an indictment of any one individual, and certainly not the folks that are in leadership positions. But I think we would all agree that there is a leadership pandemic sweeping the American Fire Service. It's a derivative of an unprecedented amount of scrutiny, information, litigation, changing laws and regulation, the economy, a giant influx of new people, an expansion of our mission, and the list goes on and on. However, we also have some just good old-fashioned problems that we don't seem to be able to solve. The biggest one, in my opinion, is a complete lack of succession planning. We are not preparing future officers for the job that they're about to face, whether it's lieutenant, captain, chief officer, or fire chief. We just are not good at it. As is normally the case, today when we asked in the class, how many of you have a robust officer development program in your fire departments, out of 27, 28 students, not one raised their hand, and they represented about 10 fire departments spanning the Western United States. That's not okay. We need to be better at mentoring, succession planning, and preparing our future bosses and leaders for promotion, and we're just falling down in that area. So if anybody wants to talk about that, text or call in about that topic, more than welcome the opportunity to talk about that. It is a huge pandemic problem that we're facing. We are seeing some incredibly despicable behavior in the stations in some cases, where firefighters are being allowed to run and do what firefighters do sometimes. When there's too much downtime, we're all capable of not exhibiting our best behavior, and we need bosses who can step in and stop it, mitigate it from happening, nip it in the bud, and keep it from expanding out and becoming something that becomes the headline or the next topic of lawsuit for the city or for your council or for your district. Can't afford that anymore. Just not okay. As we usually do in this radio show, we like to go over the NIOSH top five causal factors of firefighter line of duty death. And if you've heard the show before, you've heard us always go over it. We do it religiously because it's very important. Not only are these factors contributors and causal factors of line of duty death, they're also contributors, unfortunately, of close calls, injuries, and worse yet, lost lives of civilians who should be saved. If you look at most of your fires, most of your things that go wrong on the emergency scene, chances are one of these factors is alive and well. When multiple factors that we're about to list line up, you can expect bad things to happen. It's that simple. Whether it's an injury, a line of duty death, or again, worse yet, a loss of civilian life, I have seen it. I wish I could tell you they were second, third-hand stories, but I have seen it firsthand on my fires in my organization. Nobody is immune to this. So number one, as you've heard before, inadequate or improper risk assessment. Number two, lack of incident command. Number three, lack of accountability. Number four, inadequate communications. And number five, lack of established SOPs or failure to follow the SOPs that you do have. Let's break them down a little bit more for a few minutes, and then we should start seeing some of the students from next door come in, and then we'll get some questions from the floor. Inadequate or improper risk assessment. That's the number one problem facing us on the fire ground, on the emergency scene. Just running into a situation that we don't know what we have. We are not good at risk assessment. The question is why? Well, and these are just my opinions until somebody calls in. I get to say whatever I want, basically, until somebody in the chat room says something, or until somebody in the chat room calls in. Here's the deal. Inadequate and improper risk assessment is directly due to the fact that we are a very task-oriented profession. We love to just get our heads down and work and get the job done. That's the task level, typically represented by 0 to 6 feet on the emergency scene of the fire ground. That's good. That feeds our aggressive nature. We do need to get the job done aggressively, but we do it to the point of fault, to the point of law of diminishing returns, if you will. We can be too aggressive and too task-saturated to where we don't see what's going on around us. We don't stop to forecast and do a risk, not only assessment, but risk analysis. And this becomes a huge problem. And therefore, as the incident progresses, and people become entrapped or the roof comes in, we all shake our heads and say in the video afterwards, oh, you should have seen that coming. Well, why didn't anybody see that coming? We have experienced people on the fire ground, experienced officers. Well, the reason they didn't see it coming is because nobody stopped and took the time to do a proper risk assessment. Also, lack of training. We don't train the risk assessment enough and identify risk analysis and how important it is. Our friend Gordon Graham tells us predictable is preventable. Hopefully by now, in your mind, that should be a cliche old statement, but unfortunately, it doesn't seem to manifest itself in, again, action. We can have all the great cliches and terms and sayings in the world, but if they don't manifest in action, then they're worthless. So that's number one. Number two is lack of incident command. What does that mean? Well, unfortunately, the American Fire Service still can't decide what it wants to do. In some cases, you see the Incident Command System, or ICS. In some cases, you see the Incident Management System, or IMS. In some cases, you see a derivative of one of the two or both, a hybrid of the two, or in some cases, you see nothing at all. Again, this is a derivative of our task-oriented nature of just breaking stuff and getting it all done. Command, the use of ICS is unfortunately often even considered to be a detraction from that aggressive nature in us and somehow detracts from getting the job done and being aggressive. That is, nothing could be further from the truth. People who say that do not understand how ICS can actually help you with all five of these components, especially aggressiveness. You can be more aggressive, in fact, when you have a proper incident command system set up. You'll have better risk assessment and therefore a better level of aggressiveness appropriate to the situation as deemed appropriate. Number three, lack of accountability. We all know what freelancing is. We all know what random action is, independent action, and so forth. Independent action is a little more constructive and a good thing at times it's needed. Freelancing is not, and accountability involves multiple levels. Number one, you need to know your job and your boss, and that goes for everybody on the fire ground, from the rookie firefighter to the incident commander. Who is your boss? What is your job? Well, that's multiple layered. For example, the booth firefighter on an engine, his job is to follow his captain, do what he says, stretch that line, for example, and his boss is that captain. That captain's boss may be the incident commander, or it may be a division or group supervisor. He or she needs to know that. That's critical. Therein lies some redundancy and accountability. I know my job and my boss. My boss knows his job and his boss, and so up the chain of command and so up the incident command system on that particular fire. That's not happening. On a lot of cases, there's confusion in a lot of folks' minds on these fires that were going on as to what their job is and who their boss is. It's ridiculous. This should not be happening anymore. Well, this is supposed to be 2013. We're supposed to be a little more professional than that, people. So that's a big problem that we're facing. The incident command system can help you with this, too. You break the incident down into manageable chunks, divisions, groups, etc. And there's a mentality out there that thinks that the common, so to speak, house fire is a quote-unquote bread-and-butter operation. In my opinion, the American Fire Service is not respecting house fires. We are not respecting house fires, apartment fires, and what we deem as bread and butter no longer is. If you still think that, your head is in the sand and you haven't been watching or listening or developing your craft, or you're too stubborn and arrogant to realize that. Sorry if I'm offending anybody. If I am, call me and let's talk about it. Once we get to the folks in the class next door, which is in about 10 minutes or so, we're going to start talking to them. But that's the problem that we're facing, is lack of accountability on the job and the boss, the lack of proper use of the incident command system. Number four, inadequate communications, another derivative of our task-oriented mindset. I know company officers, they have told me this, they have done it on my fires, that think they don't need to listen to the radio. In fact, some captains who are seasoned and aggressive flat out told me, I just turn the radio off when I get there. I know my job. Well, Copernicus, that's not a great idea. We need to be able to communicate, and the best form thereof, as we all know by now, I hope, if you're listening to this show, is face-to-face communication. Face-to-face communication is undoubtedly the best form of communication. Well, when you implant division of group supervisors into your incident early, you're able to harness and get that communication, those communication lines open, and you don't overwhelm your one tactical channel. It's not hampered with feedback from multiple people with tactical channels all on the same channel, on all these radios in the same living room of the house. You're not hampered with SCBA and background noise and the like. These are just some examples. Then finally, lack of established SOPs or failure to follow the SOPs that you have. Amazing. We are fortunate to go around the country and work with departments and do classes and learn from them and about them. And it's too bad, but a lot of departments do not have relevant SOGs, SOPs. Some of them don't have any. Some of them are outdated. In this day and age, that's deplorable. We're supposed to be more professional than that. So these are the things that we talk about every show just to kind of get things rolling. So while we're waiting for our students to come in, let's talk a little bit about the leadership pandemic that we talked about earlier. Don't mistake symptoms of a lack of leadership or poor leadership for the actual problem. For example, anytime there's a firefighter injury, that's a symptom of leadership on some level. Whether there was a failure to lead the troops to train, a failure to have proper fitness, a failure to intervene on someone who smokes. I've been guilty of that. I should have talked to firefighters in the past who smoke, and it cost them their lives. There's a lot of symptoms. It could be conflict in the firehouse. It could be a crew that doesn't get along. It could be poor morale. It could be a poor leadership problem, like labor and management not getting along. Budgetary issues that are exponentially worse than they need to be. These are all symptoms. The underlying cause is a lack of leadership. And we talk a good game. We've got all kinds of curricula out there. We've got certificates as far as the eye can see. But at the end of the day, the actual act of leadership is what makes or breaks a leader, and having people follow. There are workshops that are very rare to find, but they're out there, and training that's out there that actually puts you in the position to act out. Simulations, if you will, not only for the fire ground, but for counseling sessions, for other types of actual activities that you might perform on the fire ground or in the firehouse or on the training ground or in the course of your day, maybe dealing with the public. These high-fidelity training sessions are critical. They're important. They make the difference. Firefighters don't learn by sitting and watching a PowerPoint slideshow for a day or two. They learn by doing. Critical that we recognize that. We wouldn't talk about stretching hose lines over a coffee and think it was a decent drill. We would want to go out, get dirty, get sweaty, and release those endorphins and do the task to get better at it. The same thing applies for fire ground command and tactical control. The same thing applies for a lot of the leadership skills that our company officers need, like conflict resolution, communication, public presentation, training, counseling, and so forth. So this is the kind of stuff we're talking about. So I want to hear from my folks in the chat room. If you're still out there listening, it looks like you are. Why don't you text in or chat in a few questions while we're waiting for our troops to come in from next door, because there are some topics that I'm sure you want to talk about that I'd like to talk about with you while we're waiting for them to come in. And we could hit some of those before the herd comes in here, because once they come in, we're going to have a boatload of questions. So some other things to think about and talk about. Again, FDIC is coming up in April. If some of you have not ever been, I would highly recommend you go. Make the journey, make the trek. You'll be glad you did. It's truly one of the most gratifying, fulfilling, enlightening, engaging, and energizing events that you'll go to in your career, let alone during the year of training. There's hundreds and hundreds of classes, training sessions. There's ample, copious opportunities for networking that are just abundant. There's also a tremendous amount of folks that you're going to meet, old friends that you might reacquaint yourself with, networking you can do. Truly an abundance of opportunity at every level at FDIC. So I hope you can make it. Talking about some of the training that we're doing, you can go to our website at trainfirefighters.com. Trainfirefighters is one word with an S on the end, .com. We've got classes coming up in the Bay Area, in California, in San Diego, in Washington, in Colorado, in Texas, in Dallas. We'll be there at the end of this month. And, of course, FDIC, as well as a bunch of other locations throughout the country throughout the year. One of the topics we're talking about tonight, when it comes to command that we talk about regularly, are also available on our DVD series from Fire Engineering. It's called Mastering Fireground Command, Calming the Chaos, three-part DVD series. It's a great complement to some of the other wonderful products that Fire Engineering Penn will have out there, like Frank Ritchie's Tactical Series and many, many, many others. So consider those out there as resources to you. We've been having a spike in our fire activity at Metro Fire in Sacramento. A lot of people will say the overall fires in the country are diminishing, that we're going to less fires, we're going to less fires. And really, it's not a true statement. When Ed comes on, I'll let him talk to that issue. It's not a true statement. My department alone saw an increase in about, I believe, 12% more fires last year alone. We saw an increase, even larger increase than that in overall runs. We usually would run about 60 to 65,000 runs a year as an organization. We crested the 80,000 mark. That's a significant increase, and again, more fires. So that's a fallacy, and it does a lot to disenfranchise or demotivate the troops out there when they're being told, hey, there's nothing going on. Hey, we don't run any more fires. You know, there's nothing. What that does is it erodes their motivation. It erodes their desire to train, their need to train. Very, very critical that we don't do that and corrupt the motivation that's out there. One of the things Bobby Halton and I were talking about not too long ago was the notion of practice. You know, training is one thing. We train to learn new things and new skills and so forth, but practice is really the art of honing your skills, getting better at your skills, and perfecting them. And as many of you know by watching football, any good team always practices the basics. Football teams practice blocking, catching, and so forth. And we as firefighters in our profession need to practice in the same vein and not just look at it as an occasional training session. Because what happens with training alone is we think that we don't really need to train on new things. There's a new piece of equipment or a new regulation or a new SOG or something. And I'll just train on it. Well, the problem is we think that if we've done something before, stretching line, for example, we don't need to train anymore. We've done that. I know how to stretch line. I know how to command a fire. Don't tell me how to do that. Nothing can be further from the truth. But the notion of practice, the old practice makes perfect, in the pursuit of perfection, we may reach excellence. That's something we need to be thinking about. And in this day and age, I know in my organization, my captains they're screaming right now. We are pumping so much at them right now in the form of information, new projects, more fire inspections, a ton of probationary firefighters, hundreds a year we're hiring, new programs, that they are overwhelmed in their ability to just get out and train and practice is being hampered because of that. Not any fault of the organization or anyone in it. It's just the reality of where we are right now in the American Fire Service. And it's also a derivative of closed companies. We've closed 5 engine companies at Metro Fire, which puts more pressure laterally on the other companies. They're all busier. So these are all things that are going on. They're real, and they require leadership. So what are you doing out there to fill that void? What are you doing out there to train future officers? What are you doing out there to make sure that your crews are still training and practicing and not just being inundated with administrative tasks? Those things do need to get done, but are they being given time and the priority of training and practice? These are critical elements that we need to all be working on and focusing on. So with that, I'm going to take another pay another visit to our friends at Granger while some of these crazy nitwits from class start walking in here to join us in this radio show about half an hour in.
With over 900,000 products and 31 diverse product categories, Granger is basically an anything you need supply buffet. We've got everything from safety and electrical products to hardware, hand tools, and more, so you can efficiently purchase exactly what you need from one source, saving time and trouble. And just to be sure, the buffet thing was a metaphor. Please don't eat the stuff. Buy your supplies smarter. Just call quickgranger.com or stop by a branch today. Granger, for the ones who get it done.
All righty. Again, if you're just joining us, that was an advertisement from our sponsor, Granger. We really want to thank them from Fire Engineering. They're our first official sponsor on the Blog Talk Radio program here at Fire Engineering. Okay, we had a question out on the floor here from Chief Jim Wilkowski. He's the chief up in Riverside Fire Authority up in Washington State. Chief asks, can you give us your thoughts on auditory exclusion and the impacts it has on the fire ground? Perhaps include some discussion regarding ways to overcome or address auditory exclusion. Thank you, sir. Thank you, Chief. I appreciate that. Yes, auditory exclusion. First, what is it? Auditory exclusion is the equivalent. It's the equivalent of tunnel vision. Tunnel vision, we all know, is when we start to just see a little tiny speck or through a little hole what we thought we were seeing before. When our peripheral vision goes away, and we start to focus and obsess on something that's in front of us. Auditory exclusion is the same thing. Give me an example. I've got a video of myself on fire from the command post, for a command post video that we've got, and it's basically a 3-alarm fire, and the second alarm, I trigger a second alarm, and the pager goes off, and I actually, you know, hit the pager and shut it off. Then I hit a third alarm, and the pager just continues to beep throughout the rest of the incident because I had auditory exclusion. And basically, I was to the point where I was overwhelmed by all that was going on, and I just basically, my brain shut off what it thought was unnecessary, unimportant information. So that's what auditory exclusion is. So what do we do to overcome it and address it? Well, again, Chief, it's like anything else. It's a training issue. It takes practice. When we do our simulation exercises at our command training center at Metro, we practice transfer of command. We've noticed that when we do that face-to-face, the two incident commanders that are transferring the command most likely miss critical radio traffic because of the auditory exclusion. So that has kind of driven our need to get back to a transfer of command via radio, a real quick one. Not, it doesn't take up a lot of radio time. It's just more of a quick move on, and okay, I'm in charge, now I've got it. And if the communication was clear, the assumption of command is pretty seamless. One of the other things that we've done is provided a lot of other sound background noise. When we do hands-on training, we'll run chainsaws, we'll make a bunch of noise. Same thing goes when we're practicing commanding an incident. We'll put a lot of background noise around the incident commander so that they can practice filtering the issues and the noises that aren't important. But within all of that, you want to insert critical information in that background noise to see if they pick up on it. So it's not enough for them to just shut everything out. You want them to be able to filter out the stuff they don't need and be able to grasp onto the things that are important, like a mayday, like requesting a vertical ventilation or something of that. Like, so I hope that answers the question, Chief. And with that, I'm going to go ahead and take a question from the floor from one of my students here. Neil Gomez is a firefighter here from California. Question is, how can we stay positive when everyone is worried about the budget? That's a great question. Here you go. These are all just my opinions. None of this is authority or official unless I cite something. So this is officially my opinion. How do we stay positive? Training. Train. I have been in the training division. I was in the training division for 2 years at Metro Fire. And during that time, there was a low morale issue, and that's all the budget is. It's a distractor, whether it's layoffs or company closures or whatever. And I remember one crew coming through on a rig drill yelling at me, going, you know, this is a bunch of, who cares about this rig training? We'll do our training when the chief does his job. And I just looked at him, I shook my head and I go, are you serious right now? I looked at him and I said, you've got to be kidding me. Do you really think the chief is staying up at night hoping you don't train or hoping you do because it will prove a point? At the end of the day, it's your butt that's on the line. It's the citizens that you're supposed to protect that are out there that you're going to deal with. It's a lifeless child in your arms that's going to be the one that doesn't receive the benefit of your training, not the chief. You're not going to prove a point. So my response to that is train and practice, because most fire departments that have low morale, they're more susceptible to it if they don't run a lot of calls. They have a lot of, and he's nodding his head yes for all you out there in radio land. And so training can replace that. It releases the same endorphins. It gets that same sweat that comes out during a fire. It comes out during training. The blood still flows. And from my experience, the troops love it, and it makes a difference. Okay. Next question. Is this the right forum for ICS questions? Yes. We're asked that. This is the right forum for ICS questions. Why don't you come up and right into the phone?
This is Andrew Kranitz from Daly City Fire Department. And the question I have is, in the unfortunate instance where there is a RIC deployment and you have already set up the ICF system, typically I would put the first due officer as IC, the first battalion chief as plans, and the second one is safety. If you have to have a RIC group soup, who's going to take over that position as RIC group soup? Are you going to reassign the safety officer, or is there somebody better for the job?
Thank you, sir. Great question. If I was operating under that structure that you just described, the safety officer would take it. It'd be more appropriate, in my opinion, for the safety just to take over RIC group soup. Now, let's step back. I wouldn't have plans on – I wouldn't waste, if you will, a battalion chief, a second due battalion chief as a plans guy. I wouldn't waste him as a safety officer. To me, even though safety is important, and safety officers are all well and good, as the incident commander, you're wearing the safety officer hat as well as the incident commander. If I get it, my second battalion chief on the scene is going to probably take a forward division role. That does a few things. Number one, it gets somebody's eyes and brain out in the field for me to see what's really going on, to lap the structure, to lap the house, to do a better risk assessment. Number two, that person now has better actual hands-on, eyes-on, active accountability as to what's actually happening. I'm not relying on my radio and what they're telling me only. I have somebody who's physically there, has a presence. Next thing it does is it reduces the span of control. Let's say there's two engines in a truck inside of a house. They were reporting to me. If I get a plans chief, he's reporting to me. I get a safety officer, he's reporting to me. My span of control is five. Now I've got five people talking on the radio to me, and that really doesn't help the three guys inside. If I take that BC and say, you're now interior division soup, these two engines in the truck are working for you, let me know what you need. He's in a forward position now to support them, to assess what's going on over their heads that they probably don't see, to look at the construction, the smoke, and prevent the RIC thing from happening in the first place. I don't know if that makes any sense. Okay. Thanks, sir. Any other questions from these fellows? Are you just going to stare at me like this, all of you? Really? Okay. There's a pad of paper. You don't have to talk on the radio if you don't want to. One of the things that that we talk about in this workshop is the NIOSH 5 and how ICS can help that, and that's a direct result. Whenever we go to RIC training, there's part of my brain that's always frustrated because even though RIC training is important, it's reactive. It's reactive. It means that we screwed up, we didn't see something. But if we have proper risk assessment on the fire ground, we won't need RIC. RIC's a safety net. It's a parachute after the plane breaks. It's not the be-all and end-all. Okay, got a question here from our chat room. I'm going through this battle now with my local union. Their stance is we don't lift a finger unless we're paid. That is for off-duty personnel. I believe it is mandatory training. And it is my day off. My off day, I should be paid. But if it is not mandatory. Okay, so going through a battle right now where the union is saying, unless you get paid, don't do anything. If it's off-duty training, don't do it. And follow-up to that comment is, I should have the right to attend to better myself without union pushback. If training is contingent on money and the money runs out, What do we do? Not train. This is something we talked about in our workshop today. I am all for the union. I'm all for labor. I am a labor member as a battalion chief. I've been a labor member for over 20 years. I get it. I have been politically active as part of the union. I have through and through. That being said, unfortunately, our labor folks, that mentality, I should say, is asinine. It's ridiculous to get people hurt. The very people we're trying to help in a lot of cases are cutting off their nose to spite their face, and this is an example of that. The folks in your membership who are going out and trying to better not just themselves, more importantly their job skills so they can keep their crews safe, that should be applauded. When the budget is diminished, the folks who still have the initiative to go out on their own despite pay should be championed and should be considered role models. That should be where the peer pressure is, not to not train. Because at the end of the day, if somebody dies in a fire and we have a bad incident or somebody gets injured, it's usually a derivative of training or leadership. And if we are further hampering what's already tarnished because of a budget issue, we are being foolish and becoming more a part of the problem than a part of the solution. And I'm sure somebody out there is going to be pissed off that I said that, but I really don't care. So that's my response to that. It's just interesting that the very people you're trying to protect don't want you to get better at protecting them. They would rather have you be worse at your job and then be more at risk for some silly notion that we're proving a point, or we're gonna give the middle finger to management. Silly, silly stuff. So thanks for the comment. Anything else from? Well, we got one guy fidgeting. He's thinking about it. He's looking at the pad of paper. Okay, he's going for it. Great stuff from out in chat room land. Thank you for bringing that stuff up. It matters, and unfortunately, if you your department has a labor management relationship that is so strained that they can't work together to fill the budget gap, and there's a problem that was there way before the budget ever happened. Response to my comments, nail on the head, thank you. This came out after our RIT training. And that goes back to what I was saying earlier. You actually have firefighters who you're training to be safe, more safe, to go home to their families, who say, this is stupid, I'm not going to train until the chief does his job better, or until we get paid, or until they figure out the budget. I just can't even put my head around that. When those guys said that to me, I looked at them and I shook my head and I said, why don't you just shut up and train, because it's going to help your butt. Who cares what the chief is doing? It's pretty simple. You know, it gets a little old. So, all right. One of the other things we said we would talk about is the management element, the three dimensions of leadership, management, and fire ground operations. The management element is where the budget comes in. And unfortunately, there's a gap there too. And for example, my department had to close 5 engine companies, and there were some layoffs. However, I'm happy to say that we have a very enlightened management team. I'm middle management. I'm a battalion chief. I'm talking about my bosses, and I have no aspirations to promote, so I'm not kissing their butt. So here's the deal, is we have a chief and a senior staff and management team that has done an outstanding job of finding solutions. They've fostered an outstanding relationship with labor. The labor is incredibly empowered and helps run the organization, has a lot of say in what we're doing. And there has been a lot of partnering on thinking out of the box, developing other ways to recoup costs. We are developing new programs in the area of EMS. We're developing our grant systems and getting grant money. We're changing our fee structure for our Fire Prevention Bureau, which is newly named the Community Risk Reduction Division, which opens up a whole other mindset and cost recovery model. We're increasing our false alarm responses. And in so doing, we're saying, look, we need to recoup costs for that. The fee structure that we were entitled to have, we weren't even adhering to our own fee structure that we had in place previously. So these are the types of things that management needs to work on. And when I say management, I don't mean a certain group of people. I mean the management element. And that's everybody's job, whether it's the captain on the floor trying to be a little more responsible with his crew's use of utilities around the firehouse, for example, in Sacramento. It's very, very, very easy to blow hundreds of dollars a month, if not thousands, in a firehouse where in the summertime the air conditioner is running and you've got the windows open, it's 100 degrees out. It's ridiculous. Little stuff like that makes a difference. Sending that message out to the troops on a regular basis makes a difference. But there is a lot that we're doing to kind of bridge that gap and kind of prevent that budget problem, the economy that we're having around the country from being as much of an issue. And that's, again, a derivative of leadership in the management realm. So got another question that's almost done. He's writing on the side of the margin, and here we go. Question is, do you find inconsistency in the way command modes are used, investigation mode, fast attack mode, and formal command? And shouldn't we always start in investigation mode until a proper size-up is completed? All right. Thanks, Brian. Yeah, there is a very inconsistent way. When you guys are still in class, I made a comment on the show here that there are as many different ways of commanding fires in this country as there are people. It's amazing. there's the whole ICS contingent, there's the IMS contingent, and there's the whatever the hell I feel like today contingent. It doesn't follow either one. And it's wrong. It's not okay. We need to be beyond that. So with that in mind, we have got a major problem out there in the field with differing methodologies on investigation, on attack, and so forth, or command. There needs to be what Bruno and his sons call, you know, standard situation, standard response, standard outcome. And this goes back to command level training. This goes back to simulation training, command training, which we don't do enough of in this country, where, you know, we would all expect the certain type of hose stretch for a certain type of situation, a certain type of hose choice, a certain type of set of appliances used for a given situation, right? We don't expect that of our command officers. We just figure, they're all capable. They'll just do it. They have a different style. Well, that's like saying paramedics have a different style. His style of paramedicine is to use atropine more. That's just his style. To me, that's what I hear when I hear people say, well, his command style is this. There should be standard operating guidelines for command, just as there are regulations and SOGs for paramedicine, as there are for just about everything else in the world. So for whatever reason, command has remained this immune place, this white elephant in the room. And so because of that, it's not okay. Yeah, we do have varying ways of doing stuff, not just on those three modes, but on everything. From when and how to set up groups and divisions to whether or not to have a plan section or an operations section on a house fire. It's asinine. We should have standard ways of doing it. Now, granted, there are variables, staffing levels, response levels. There's a lot of variables out there that drive some of that. But even in agencies, among different shifts, among different chiefs on the same shift, there is variances that just should not be tolerated from the troops. It's ridiculous. Does that answer the question? Okay, he's nodding yes, so that's hopefully going to work. All right, we got a call. I'm guessing it's Eddie Hatfield from the 951 area code. Ed, is that you?
It's me. Welcome. Hey, I'm sorry I'm late to the show.
No problem. I know you're teaching in Lincoln. How's it going?
Things are going good. We're just wrapping up three days at the Les Lukert Winter Fire Conference in Kearney, Nebraska. We were down there with Anthony Avilo, PJ Norwood, Duffy, and a host of other people, including Brian Giles. We had an excellent conference down there and then spent the last couple days here in Lincoln going over a lot of high-rise stuff. So things are going good. A lot going on in the Midwest, and in particularly, as you were talking about, related to organizing and structuring the command process so that the fire ground is not only much more efficient, but also operates to a higher degree of safety for not only our personnel, but for the citizens as a whole.
Beautiful. So Anthony Avilo's with you in Nebraska?
He was. You know, we only allowed him to stay so long because, you know, people from the East Coast don't bring great weather. So we shipped him back to the East Coast. Now, Anthony was down here at the Les Lukert concert, and like I said, with PJ Norwood and Duffy, myself, and a couple other regional instructors that were teaching at the Les Lukert conference.
Beautiful.
Yeah, it worked out real well. So a lot of discussion on command, a lot of discussion on one of the things that you touched on, and it is how to implement a efficient command model in both career organizations as well as the very rural volunteer organizations, and do so in a manner that provides a level of efficiency and standardization given the varying staffing levels. Because, as you know, in at least in Nebraska, you know, the bigger organizations such as Omaha and Lincoln, which are large metropolitan agencies, are also surrounded by and not too far right out of their city district or city boundaries are surrounded by a number of smaller volunteer rural agencies. In fact, met with the fire chief from an organization where the town of 350 people total. He was a volunteer fire chief and provided fire and EMS services to that town of 350 people with a total of 32 volunteers. So, you know, how do you do that? And then the comparables and that between that and providing the same level of service to, let's say, Lincoln, Nebraska, which has 13 stations and is what would be considered a mini metro.
Well, that is one of the big challenges, but that variable, in my opinion, we talked about this, you and I, over drinks. The variable that we're talking about was staffing and response levels and company availability and response times. That's one thing. We're talking about variances in the same department on the same shift. You've got three or four battalion chiefs per shift, and they're all doing it a different way on the shift. And so you could have a house fire in Battalion 17, and 4 hours later on that same shift in the same fire department, Battalion 23, the exact same house fire is going to run completely differently. That's the stuff that makes me go nuts.
Well, and it should make you go nuts, and Donnie, and I'm sure our listeners understand that. You know, I mean, it's intolerable. And the bottom line is that each organization is going to have, you know, unique features to the organization. And each organization is going to have an independent culture, and it's going to have unique aspects that, whether it's staffing levels or response levels or whatever the case may be. But at the end of the day, there's a template for organizing the fire ground that has been time-tested and proven. And, you know, the escalation of command from the task, tactical, to strategic is very well documented. It's in place, and it works. And the implementation, the use of ICS principles across the board are very well utilized, no matter what the size of the organization, no matter if you're a career volunteer. It's just what pieces of the puzzle do you utilize based upon the complexity of the incident. And for an organization, and you and I have both traveled enough that we've seen them and or even to a point operated within them. For an organization to have a mix-match of the way that the organization manages the fire ground based upon personalities is just intolerable any longer. And, you know, what you really do is you really open yourself up to, and there's a severe exposure to liability. Because at the end of the day, if battalion chief one on A shift is managing his or her fire ground vastly different based upon his personal preferences or his or her personal paradigm, vastly different than battalion chief two on C shift, and one or the other has an incident where people get hurt, the exposure to liability to not only that individual incident commander, but the exposure and the culpable liability to the organization is huge, because any lawyer will call those people into court and say, you know, are you aware of the ICS principles? Can you accurately describe to me how you utilize the ICS or NIMS principles in your organization and in this particular incident? And if it deviates from what would be considered national standards or a standardized approach based upon the testimony of a subject matter expert, then you're going to lose in court. And at the end of the day, if people don't think that that's the truth, then all you have to do is look at the law enforcement community. And right now, today, there are a number of fire departments that are being sued, and individuals are being named in lawsuits for not utilizing a standard methodology of managing the incident that has resulted in not only life loss or injury, but also dollar loss and property value loss. So, you know, it's time that the fire service really pulls their head out and realizes that, you know, until we start providing a higher level of continuing education to our incident commanders, and until the fire service starts holding incident commanders accountable to a standardized approach and practice to the fire ground management, and until well-written, documented policies, procedures, and training mandates are in place in organizations that fit that organization and aren't cookie-cutter, cut-and-paste documents that are stolen from another organization, we're doing nothing more than perpetuating a situation that's going to end up getting somebody landing in jail. And that's just it. So, you know, if you enjoy cuddling and long, dark showers with a guy by the name of Bubba, keep doing things the way you're doing, because that's where you're heading.
Well put. Well put. I like it when you talk like that. Not that part, but the other part.
Well, it's you know, I mean, it is. I agree with you. It's ridiculous. You know, and it's interesting because there are people out there that are really trying to get the fire service to understand this. Like I said, and I had the opportunity to be with some of them this weekend. And, you know, we all see where there's a need. And unfortunately, I think that there's a lot of personal bias and paradigms, as well as a lens in many organizations that are unwilling to take a step back and say, you know what, we need to do this as one organization. And I'm willing to put my personal bias aside and do what's best for the greater good of the organization, and most importantly, do what's best for the greater good of our community. And as you said, and I caught you on the tail end, we've done it in EMS. We've done it for many years in EMS. There's no reason why we can't do it in structural or wildland firefighting. In fact, in wildland firefighting, they do it. So let's just cut to the chase. Structural firefighting, because any incident management team, whether you're a Type 1, Type 2, or Type 3 team nationwide, manages the incident the exact same way.
Yep. Beautiful. Okay. All right, another question from the floor. The question here says, I work for a fire department that has closed half its engines. We currently get 3 engines and 1 truck on a first alarm assignment. Our truck has been reduced to 3 people, which means we can no longer split the crew and send 2 to the roof and 2 inside to search. How do we perform an effective and timely primary search if we are fighting a fire that requires 2 lines while honoring 2 out and or RIC? That's a great question. This is reality in a lot of departments. One of the things that we talked about with this department a couple of weeks ago during training was, look, number one, if you have anything remotely close to a working fire that you think Susie hit the apron, call for more resources. That's number one. Get them coming early. Second thing is we need to realize that 2 out and RIC are 2 different things. Most departments, IRIT or 2 out is 2 people. Just the minimum needed to get a second line at the front door, for example, and get a couple of folks in place to affect immediate rescue or control egress if necessary for the first team. Whereas RIC is typically an engine company, minimum of 3, a cache of tools and so forth, which is more involved. And the situation dictates. If you've got a situation where you desperately need vertical ventilation, then that truck's going to go to the roof. Most likely, and the 3 of them are going to go to the roof. The first line is going to go inside. The second line is going to position at the door. And if in this case that was brought up to us, if it requires a second line, then as soon as that third engine gets there, they're going to push in that second line, unless the line needs to go in sooner due to potential safety issues for the first crew. And I think a lot of people forget this, and I'll shut up in a minute here, Ed, and let you go on this, but a lot of people don't realize that if you have a hose line at the front door, it's a 2-out team line, and you see fire conditions worsening that are going to hamper the egress or potentially infringe upon the safety of the first crew, then you're obligated to go in with that 2-out line and make it better. 2-out lines are not there only for a mayday. 2-out lines are there to go in to prevent a mayday. That's the whole point, and that's why Rick can come typically after that IRIT or two-out team. And now that you've got two companies inside and a third engine company getting ready for Rick, you're now positioned with two companies that hopefully can perform a search, albeit not ideal, albeit you want to have them off a hose line and focusing only on the search. But at least you have two companies with two hose lines and a vertical vent going, and that's going to make things a lot better. So I don't know if that helps. But, again, call out the resources early, and it's situationally dependent. Go ahead, Ed.
You know, I want to look at it from a little bit more of a scientific approach. I think, you know, it's a general question. But really what we need to do is we need to break down what the fire ground is dictating. So let's address first thing. We have three engines and one truck going. It's a three-person truck. No longer has the ability to perform split company operations. So my assumption initially is that the person asking the question is stating that this is a residential occupancy where normally with a four-person truck they go two to the roof, two to the inside to perform search.
Right.
So with that being said, we have to, as a fire service, recognize that the vast majority of most all current residential structure fires that we respond to today are going to be in an underventilated stage upon our arrival. And in fact, the area or compartment of fire of origin has already transitioned through all four stages of the fire growth phase. In other words, it's gone from incipient to growth to flashover to fully developed and is most likely now in the decay stage or what we call the underventilated stage. Now, this does not mean it's any less dangerous. In fact, it's the most dangerous point because what it's seeking is oxygen. So really what this boils down to is the most important component of this firefight is the coordinated actions between the initial interior attack crews and the truck company vertically ventilating the roof or providing the appropriate level and type of ventilation on this particular structure. So for sake of argument, we're just going to say that this is a large two-story single-family residential structure and that the truck has gone to the roof to perform vertical ventilation to eliminate the potentiality of a hostile event occurring from an air track being provided by the entry team going in the Alpha Division on the front door. And we have a rapidly advancing or rapidly progressing interior fire as a result of lack of or inefficient or uncoordinated ventilation. Now, what we know scientifically is that if you take a two-story, large volume structure, a home built sometime between 1980 and 2006, that the interior volume of the structure is going to be one-third times more greater than the actual footprint of the structure. So we got a large volume, high ceiling, 10-foot ceiling structure. Our interior fire attack is going to differ than that of a single-family residential single-story structure with an 8-foot ceiling. So we're not going to go into the interior structure with a single line and perform gas cooling measures in an attempt to find the compartment or area of origin. So we're going to go in and we're going to begin solid stream applications in coordination with the vertical ventilation while managing the airflow at the Alpha Division. So that second company that is providing that secondary line at the front door is also going to manage the door to eliminate the air track flow to reduce the potentiality of that hostile event. Now once that door is cracked, once that seal is popped, we have 120 seconds before we're going to have an increase in temperature and fire progression within the compartment or area. That's a known. So 120 seconds is what? 2 minutes. So you got 2 minutes from the time you pop the seal on that door till you make the room of origin. And the little girl and the puppy didn't survive that room, so we write that off. That is not our problem. But you need to make that room, and you need to do it in coordination with the truck. So the coordination between the company advancing the primary line and the truck company is going to be critical. And in most cases, that company that's going to advance that line is actually going to wait at the door, with the door closed or the door having been forced and checked for a victim in the immediate area before they advance until the truck can get a hole in the roof and pop the top off this structure. But in the case of a coordinated attack, 37% of the time between the front door and the fire room, we're going to find our victims. And then we need to look at what the victims, what the potentiality of the victims may be. We're going to find that if there are victims, if there are adult victims beyond teenage years, we're going to find them between the front door and the fire. That if they're victims of teenage age, we're going to find them located in a compartment within the structure, typically in their rooms or in bathrooms. And if their age is below teenage years, we're going to find them typically in their rooms, in closets, under beds, or in corners. So then that helps you to be able to manage and organize your incident, even from an incident command perspective, because I know that in an underventilated stage, I don't have fire racing through this house. I'm going to have fire in 2 minutes racing through this house if I just kick in the front door and go marching in there without a coordinated ventilation approach. And I also know that I'll have fire racing through this house and potentially trapping, harming, or killing survivable victims within this house if I perform actions that are uncoordinated with the interior companies. I also know that I won't be able to make the room if I go into the house and I start utilizing the inappropriate or the incorrect nozzle setting or application based upon the ceiling height. So these are all things that people need to recognize and understand. And in fact, I'll tell you right now, that if you've got a rookie firefighter and he wasn't able to explain what I just explained to our listeners, then you're not doing your job training your people. And that's just the bottom line. Because rookie firefighters need to know, based upon ceiling height, action, and coordination, exactly what type of nozzle selection and fire flow formula they're using. This is a very minimal fire flow formula that is going to be applied to this structure. However, the right nozzle selection and coordination and ventilation aspect is going to be needed to be applied to this. And you have to recognize where your victims are going to be located. If our victims are located in a compartment, which based upon, again, who they are and how old they are, and that compartment door is closed, we've got a huge, huge, huge advantage in this particular situation. And having limited resources, although not the greatest, is not as bad as we had potentially thought. And in fact, having a company that could perform a vent in our search might be the best option rather than trying to bring that victim through the contaminants of the interior of the house. And that could be that while the initial attack crew makes the room of origin, the truck provides the ventilation, that secondary IRIC or exterior crew is performing a visual 360 on the structure and looking for areas of safe refuge. So there's a lot more to this question than just where do I put my people. There's really a lot of science and data that needs to be applied to how you're going to manage this incident, what you're doing, why you're doing it, how you're doing it, and you're looking for a lot more data to make decisions. So,
I think we had you on mute the past 10 minutes. Could you go over that again? No, I'm just kidding.
That's jacked up, dude.
You know I'm going to do that all the time. Now, thank you for that. I'm glad you came in on that because that is something that you explain. You always explain that so poignantly, and that's a derivative of all the time and effort you've put into that arena. And not only that, but being on the UL study and all the other committees and stuff that you're working on. So thanks for that, because it is a lot more to it than just a simple answer. It is so, and it's so cliche to say, oh, it's situationally derivative. Oh, it depends on the situation. Well, and then we leave it at that without elaborating on what those critical factors are that drive your decisions in a given situation, which you just did so poignantly. So thank you. Our friend in the back who asked the question is smoking a cigarette and having a beer right now. So he thanks you.
Well, I'll just say this, and I'll keep it short, is you know, I spent some time up in Washington 2 weeks ago with some people that are doing some really comprehensive studies on interior volume of structures and how it applies to fire ground tactics. And there's a lot of information that's going to be coming out on the fact that the interior arrangement and volume and ceiling heights have with our tactical application to interior operations based upon immediacy of resources and how that couples with ventilation. So these are things that the fire ground commander needs to start thinking about. I mean, that is the level in which we need to undress our buildings.
Amen. Is the person's name doing that up there? His initial Scott Corrigan?
Yes, it is.
Okay. He's going to be doing some informal get-togethers, I'm sure you know, at FDIC to discuss these topics of nozzle flow application, angle approach, and so mm-hmm. forth, which is all huge. Next question, last question, because we're going to have to call it a night here. Question on the floor is, our fire chief has chosen to put our new hires through an in-house academy. All of our current firefighters went through a county in-service academy. The county academy is run by qualified instructors. How do I promote the chief's unpopular decision? What I would say to that is a lot of times it's an educational issue when there's a decision that's made. The troops sometimes just want to be informed. Most of the time when they don't like something, it's because they don't know the facts. And most of the time they know about two-fifths of the facts, especially when it's a higher-level decision like from the fire chief. So educate them. Why was the decision made? I'm guessing it was a financial decision, but could have been something else. If it was, then find out what it is. Whatever the reason is, as a captain, which is the question is, how do I promote the chief's unpopular decision? Our job as officers is to be an ambassador to the chief. And if there's a case where we disagree with a decision, our job is to use the chain of command upward and privately to disagree, to show our alternative ideas, for example, to say, hey, I don't agree with this, is why, have you thought of this? Once that's exhausted and you get the information you need, you may not be satisfied. You probably won't in some cases. Your job is to then go out and not necessarily hold court about how great it is. Just don't talk about it. It is what it is. When it does come up, then it's, there's a decision the chief made, and here's why he made it. Well, I think that's BS. Well, you can think whatever you want. This is America, but you can't act on it in this job. And so our job is to stay in our lane and to move forward. Now, here maybe is an opportunity to have some internal instructors step up, some people that are good instructors who haven't thought about teaching before, who were not in the academy because of other political issues. Now they have an opportunity to step up. Now we have an opportunity to train our folks exactly how we want them to operate in our fire department. So there are other opportunities. That's just specific to this particular case. Ed, what do you want to say about it?
I mean, I think you pretty much hit the nail on the head. I do think it's important for anybody that's going to carry forth the message from administration to understand why the decisions were made and to be able to convey to the personnel on the floor as much as they can, because there may be certain information that you're not allowed to convey, but to convey as much information you can, because information is knowledge, and when people have an understanding of why and how the decision came about, they may not like it, but at least they can appreciate it. And I also agree that it gives the organization an opportunity. And what I would say is that, given that I have the latitude to do this, is I would sit down with the organization and peel back the onion on the previous type of training and identify strengths and weaknesses of the previous type or location of training, and then take those strengths and implement them in the program that you're using or going to be using, the new academy, and then identify the weaknesses and ask and create buy-in from the group in developing a process or programs or some level of training which improves upon those already previously identified weaknesses, so that you provide a higher product or a higher level of training to your people in your in-house academy. And that tends to create that buy-in. So although you're not speaking ill of the previous level of training, everybody knows that there's ways and areas that we can improve. So take the strengths, improve upon the weaknesses, and provide a higher quality of product through group participation, group activities, and get the buy-in and get people engaged in creating the highest level of product, because you're going to have the employees.
Did you break it up a little bit? Are you still there?
Yeah, I'm sorry.
He's nodding his head. He likes it. He said thank you.
All right, awesome.
Excellent. Oh, well, unless we have, I don't have anything else from our chat folks. And unless, Ed, you have anything, or anybody in the class here has? Nope. Ed, do you have anything you want to add before we call it a night?
No. Hey, thanks. Sorry I came on late. I was actually over at the University of Nebraska Strength and Conditioning Center. And I do want to share this. I was over at the University of Nebraska Strength and Conditioning Center working with some of the strength and conditioning coaches on some very exciting information that's going to be coming out, that's going to be pushed out to the fire service to help improve what is our most valuable asset in the fire department, and that's our people, and to improve not only their physical conditioning, overall physical conditioning and fitness, but also improve their physical conditioning and fitness in a manner that will help them to make better cognitive decision-making processes under stress. So there's a lot of science that's going to be coming out here related to the human performance level and human performance aspect in the fire service. Also, next week I'm going to be up in the state of Washington again, home away from home. I'm going to be teaching at the Washington State Fire Officers Annual Training Conference in Yakima. We're going to be doing Captain's College, as well as a new program that we're doing in conjunction with the CrossFit community, which is CrossFit for Fire. We're going to be offering CrossFit programming and morning workouts for all participants each morning. We did that at the Les Luker concert. It was absolutely outstanding and well attended. And then I'll be presenting a program called Developing the Operational Athlete, a functional fitness program within your fire service agency. So we're starting to really peel back the onion and do a lot of extensive scientific work in how overall fitness, conditioning, mobility, rehabilitation, sleep deprivation, and nutrition all encompasses our most valuable asset, the firefighter, in their levels of performance in reducing not only injuries, but increasing cognitive decision-making on the fire ground. So that's going to be very exciting. So if anybody's going to be coming to that conference, you're going to be up in Washington, give me a call, and I'd love to get together with you and chat.
Great. Thank you, sir. As usual, you're on the cutting edge of everything going on out there, so we thank you for that. Thanks for joining us from Nebraska. We're going to say goodbye from Monterey, California, from our latest workshop site where we're doing a bunch of officer training as well. Thanks, everyone, out there for listening, and God bless to everybody, and be safe. Talk to you next time.